Iraq is close to the edge. On the other side of that edge, perhaps civil war, maybe the disintegration of a country. Yes, American troops are out, but the current crisis has already prompted the White House to think about how to get involved again. So there are lots of unknowns, not to sound too Rumsfeldian. And yesterday we asked you to send in your questions. We got some great ones back, so thank you for that. And we're going to try and chew on some of your questions today and in the coming days. Keep them coming, by the way. Ask away at facebook.com/PRI the world. Mark Putsky asked this one: what will happen if ISIS reaches the green zone? That's the supposedly safe zone in Baghdad where the U.S. Embassy is located. Mark's question is a great starting point because A, the militant group ISIS is threatening the Iraqi capital, and B, President Obama just decided to send nearly 300 U.S. troops to Iraq to protect the embassy and other American diplomatic posts. Residents of the city are on edge, for sure. Today they heard news that 4 bullet-ridden bodies were discovered in a Shia neighborhood. The victims are believed to have been Sunnis. Earlier, we reached a New York Times reporter, Rod Nordland, in Baghdad on a scratchy phone line. I asked him about the mood in the city.
Well, I think the mood is the same as it has been the last few days. People are concerned. They're not panicking. A lot of people are organizing themselves into these volunteer militias. And today we've had a couple reports of what looked like tick-for-tack killings in Bakoub in the north.
Right. I mean, it's hard to know what those killings are about. Is it sectarian killings? Has the war kind of already arrived in a small way?
It certainly looks like sectarian killings. The killings first of all, there have been a lot of sectarian killings in the last few months because ISIS, these Islamic extremists, are killing people just because they're Shia, wherever they go. The kind of things that people are really fearing here, and we get into this cycle of we kill you, you kill us, and it goes on and on.
So how is this all playing with Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki? How's he taking all of this in?
He's certainly not doing anything that people have been encouraging to do to try to resolve things. You know, both America and Iran have both kind of very publicly urged him to try to get some kind of reconciliation going with Sunnis in the country. There are a number of steps he could take, and he's just absolutely refused to take. And Chief Advisor for Reconciliation the other day said flatly there's no hope of reconciliation in the middle of a war. So he's kind of hunkered down, and that's not a very encouraging scenario.
Rod, do you feel safe in Baghdad right now?
I feel safe right now, but I think it's entirely possible that the situation will dramatically deteriorate and events could move very quickly in a very dangerous direction.
New York Times reporter Rod Nordland speaking with us from Baghdad. Over the past decade, of course, the Iraqi capital has lived through many perilous moments. Our former colleague Ayub Nouri lived in Baghdad and reported for The World from there after the U.S. invasion. We've been hearing his thoughts on the crisis in Iraq for the past few days. He's now in Toronto and an editor with the Kurdish news service Rudaw. Ayub says at first during the war, Baghdad actually felt safe.
It was enjoyable working there for the first 2 years of the invasion because there was major change and I could see the rest of the country and travel around. But it became too dangerous for me or many people, millions of people who left the country. It was impossible to work safely or even go for a walk safely. And now it's happening again. There was another period of safety and calm in 2008 and 2009, and now we are back to square one, basically. Today, Iraq is like 2007 at the peak of the sectarian violence.
And today, are there many Kurdish people living in Iraq outside of the Kurdish autonomous region?
Yes, that's why in any area, town or village where Kurds live, Kurdish Peshmerga have moved in to protect them. But Baghdad itself also has a considerable Kurdish population. But I should say that they get on well with the Iraqi government because that a group of Kurds who live in Baghdad belong to the Shiite face of Islam, while the majority of Kurds are Sunnis. So the war is so sectarian, I should tell you, that we had some Kurdish drivers going to Mosul at the height of this war happening. And the Islamic militants had said, you can go freely because you, even though you are a Kurd, but you are a Sunni, and we are Sunnis. Our fight is with the Shiite government. And in Iraq, if you are a Shia, you are fine, no matter what language you speak.
Wow, that's a very granular kind of sense of identity, isn't it?
Yes, it's a Shiite-Sunni war, and they say it clearly. That's what their problem is with. There's a clear distinction. And I think with the local support or sympathy that the Islamic fighters have, that's why they were so successful. We have pictures, reports of the Iraqi army abandoning their post and uniform and guns hours before the Islamic fighters arrive for two reasons. First, they want to go home to their kids and they see no reason in fighting. And second, because sometimes before the Islamic fighters arrive, the local population rise and take care of the army and police.
Ayub, I know you live in Toronto and you're not in the crossfire right now, but you've got friends and presumably some family still there. How worried are you by events this week in Iraq?
Well, it's really worrisome because both the Kurds and the Iraqis and everyone has been trying to reach some kind of agreement and stability and create a new Iraq. And I have been involved in it for 10 years working there as a reporter, traveling and talking to people. And it's sad to see that it's going back again to what it was like 10 years ago. I think one way or another, the international community, the Iraqi leaders and everyone should sit down with these Sunnis and see what they want. You cannot ignore them anymore. Even if you suppress them today, in a few years' time, there will be another Al-Qaeda-affiliated group answering people's demands and creating more trouble.
Ayub Nouri reported for us from Iraq during the war. He's now in Toronto and an editor with the Kurdish news service Rudaw. As Ayub mentioned a minute ago, Iraqi army soldiers have deserted in droves rather than fight the insurgents. We got a question on Facebook about that. J.R. Bettis asked if there wasn't any warning before tens of thousands of soldiers walked off. We can't answer that right now, but let's hear from Global Post reporter Susanna George. She's in Erbil in northern Iraq and has spoken with some of those deserters.
You know, I was expecting these soldiers to be really embarrassed about what happened and not want to talk about it, but it was actually just the opposite. They wanted to brag about their bravery. Here's some of the tape I have from Hassan. He's originally from Samarra. He was stationed in Mosul. So he's saying there that he had plenty of training, enough equipment, that his division could have fought against any army. But the only problem was that their commanders betrayed them. Other soldiers told me the same thing. They said that they were holding militants back and then one morning woke up to find their commanders gone.
So they're blaming this on the commanders. They're not saying they deserted.
No, they're saying that it's all the commander's fault and that without any orders, without any superiors, they had no choice but to flee.
We've heard that senior Iraqi military leaders are colluding with ISIS. Is that, did anybody that you spoke with say that?
Yes, that's what all of the soldiers who I spoke to said, that they heard the commanders were promised large amounts of money to flee. Others said that they heard the commanders were promised prestigious government appointments in some future ISIS state. But that's all rumors at this point.
How old are these deserters?
They ranged in age. I spoke to some guys who were in their 20s and 30s, others who were in their 40s and 50s. Most of them had been in the military for 7, 8, 11 years.
And so what's the morale like for those soldiers still left on the battlefield?
What we do know is from speaking to sources in the Iraqi military and from Maliki's comments is that the military is trying to regroup after these mass desertions. They're calling up these mostly Shia militias and they're calling back deserters to the capital to prepare for a push north onto Crete. And that's a city that fell to these Al-Qaeda-inspired militants last week.
Do these deserters that you spoke with, do they have a desire to rejoin the army at some point?
Yes. Everyone I spoke to said that they were itching to get back on the battlefield, that they wanted to protect their home. You know, a lot of these guys are from Mosul. They still have relatives who are in Mosul who they said that they feel guilty for not being able to protect. And they put all of the blame on these commanders. They said that they betrayed them. And they're now trying to reenlist in the army to either fly back to Baghdad or to be redeployed elsewhere so that they can continue to fight against these Al-Qaeda-inspired militants.
Were there a lot of deserters who went to northern Iraq?
Yes, there were thousands who came into the semi-autonomous Kurdish region. I spoke to officials at the Iraqi Airways office, which the military was providing free tickets to deserters to go back to Baghdad. And at the Iraqi Airways office, they said they had issued over 1,000 tickets to deserters to return to Baghdad to regroup for this push north.
How does Maliki feel about the deserters? I mean, if they get back to Baghdad, will they be welcomed?
Well, that's actually an interesting thing here. We're seeing mixed messages. While people who I've spoken to in the Iraqi military say that, first of all, they say that these soldiers aren't technically deserters because they agree with the soldiers that they were practically forced to flee when their commanders abandoned them. But Maliki is saying that these deserters could face execution. He's calling them weaklings and cowards. He had some very strong words for deserters in a televised address he gave over the weekend. He said that they should not think that they're safe.
And with these claims that their commanders kind of melted away, that their commanders were the weak ones, is there any desire among these deserters you spoke with for those days when the U.S. military took charge of the army in Iraq?
Well, that's something that's definitely on everyone's mind here. Whenever I introduce myself to people and say that I work for an American media company, the first response is usually jokingly asking, so are the troops coming back? But these Sunni soldiers, more seriously, these Sunni soldiers who I spoke to, they trained very closely with the U.S. military in Mosul, and they miss the U.S. troops. They said that after the U.S. troops left, they don't get as much respect as they used to get when the U.S. troops were here.
Yeah, a joking reaction, but in that joke, it sounds like there's some seriousness.
Yes.
Reporter Susanna George, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Global Post reporter Susanna George in Erbil, northern Iraq there. So given the desertions, what kind of power is ISIS bringing to bear on the Iraqi army? If the army melted away in such large numbers, you'd think ISIS has a lot of firepower, or do they?
You're talking about fairly lightweight weaponry that there is no shortage of people making these things, nor is there any shortage of existing stockpiles in places like Syria or Iraq. So if you're not getting it from a state supporter, you can capture this stuff. ISIS is sort of a classic militia group in the sense that it has favored light and easy to support, mobile and easy to hide weaponry over, you know, the heavier stuff that you might see in a government force.
Coming up on The World, more on the weapons ISIS has and where they're coming from. Some are actually old stock from the American occupation, which, as we've heard on the show, is heartbreaking for vets who fought in Iraq. And speaking of vets, I want to thank all of you who wrote to The World and to me on Facebook and Twitter after my thoughts a week ago about my own father, a vet and one of the many supporting personnel during the D-Day invasion. Dad died 2 weeks ago, and your thoughts and comments and support were more valuable than you may ever know. So thank you very much for that.